Good morning. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food. What is there about the beginning of a new year that causes us to think of making changes in the way we do certain things? I'm not certain this is why we do it, but the thinking is what leads us to make New Year's resolutions and possibly making a mental inventory as to where we are, where we might like to do during the next calendar year, and possibly taking a mental inventory of where we are and what we might like to do during the next calendar year. During the past year and the next year, we will try to keep you up to date with the latest trends in food and health issues and hopefully make some positive suggestions on these subjects. We live in a fast-moving world, and it's often difficult for those of us who prefer to move at a slower pace. Let's see how we do. A new wide-sweeping food safety bill has passed the U.S. Senate in December, including the fingerprints of both of our U.S. senators. Senator Kay Hagan, a Democrat from Greensboro, helped wrestle significant amendment meant to protect small farms and food producers from federal oversight. Senator Richard Burr, a Winston-Salem Republican, was an original co-sponsor of the bill. He co-sponsored an amendment that requires the Food and Drug Administration to conduct education outreach to help farmers comply with the law. Hagan spent several weeks working on negotiations for the so-called Tester-Hagan Amendment pushed by her and Senator John Tester, a Democrat from Montana. This amendment exempts small farms and food processing facilities with less than $500,000 a year in annual sales from federal oversight. Also exempted are those farms and facilities that sell to consumers within a 275-mile radius of their facilities. The small business world would still be subject to state and local regulations. A foodborne outbreak traced to a small farm would remove the exemption and bring in federal oversight. It's these small farmers who produce homegrown, locally grown, primarily produce, she said. Many times it's a husband and wife farming. Some farms would have to spend $25,000 to write a hazard preparation plan, enough to put them out of business, she said. Irvin Leinberger, who grows blackberries and grapes in Kings Mountain, about 30 miles west of Charlotte, has long been interested in seeing better food safety rules. I think it's going to help quite a bit, he said, who hosted Hagan on his farm in June. The food safety bill is a more sweeping set of regulations than what we've been working with. In a statement released after the passage of the bill, Senator Burr said, "I voted in favor of Senate Bill 510 today because I believe it is important that we modernize and update our approach to food safety to address issues that stem from our increasingly global food supply. After months of discussion and debate, I'm confident the final version of this bill will work for North Carolina and will protect small processors and farms." Last year, we told you the fire that destroyed the longtime Johnston County restaurant Holt Lake Barbecue and Seafood. And since that fire, a sign out in the front said, "Be back soon." And they made good on their pledge. The new building looks much like the one that burned in April, and the menu will be the same with a few additions. The new Holt Lake is an updated version of its 30-year-old predecessor with brand new tables and equipment. Also, wood panel walls have given way to drywall. "We're just more modern," Barefoot said. The old restaurant was reduced to a concrete pad over the summer, but the layout of the L-shaped dining room hasn't changed. The cash register and drive-through window are in the same spots, and parts of the restaurant can still be closed off for meetings and special events. "We didn't change any of the inside of the dining room," Barefoot said. "Regulars can expect the same menu items with the usual choice of beef or pork barbecue and array of seafood. But with a larger kitchen, Holt Lake has room to accommodate those who would rather have their seafood broiled or grilled instead of fried. You've had more people that are health conscious than there were in the past," Mr. Barefoot said. The veteran staff, about 30 people, will be back as well. Only a few have moved away since the fire. The restaurant's insurance covered their lost wages over the past several months. And with the same folks waiting tables, customers can continue to expect a pitcher of sweet tea on every table and a complimentary dessert dished out before the meal. Barefoot says he's still tussling with his insurance company to cover the full loss, but is determined to reopen. He had hoped to have reopened at least a couple of months earlier. It's good to hear that an old eating place is back in business. Congratulations. It turns out that the family may be the essential ingredient for a family-owned restaurant, especially one that's been a part of the Raleigh landscape for almost a half a century. And that's what the folks of Amedeo's are thinking. Founded in 1963 by Dick DeAngelis, the Italian restaurant soon became a local favorite, including especially with North Carolina State sports fans. But in later years, the restaurant on Western Boulevard ran into financial difficulties. In January 2008, the company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, but was able to keep the doors open. 10 months ago, it was purchased by the first non-family members in its 47-year history. The new owners were David Harris and Rodney Bird, experienced restaurateurs who started the Remington Grill chain. They received praise for their extensive physical renovation of the restaurant, but people missed the family touch. So after a long hiatus, Dick DeAngelis' son Rick became partner in the restaurants where he grew up. His dad, he said, is still involved, but not in day-to-day operations. Rick DeAngelis previously opened his own restaurant, Amedeo's North, and has always stated that the two restaurants were separate. Amedeo's North is being run by other members of the family for now. We kind of came to an agreement that we kind of need to work together as a team, he said, so I've got a partnership with these guys. My main focus right now is getting this place back to where it was. The old menu is back. The blue cheese dressing is back. We wish them well. It appears we're not always ready to accept some changes. Among the various plans that may reach completion this year is a long-awaited and long-delayed Chick-fil-A restaurant in Cameron Village in Raleigh may finally be poised to become reality. It's been nearly 4 years since the Atlanta-based fast food chain confirmed plans to open the nation's first two-floor Chick-fil-A in Raleigh Shopping Center. But the original plans to put the restaurant in the former Village Eye Care building on Cameron Street was scrapped after it decided the space was too small. Officials from Chick-fil-A and Cameron Village property management company Regency Centers then switched to Plan B, opting to put the restaurant at Woodburn Road and Cameron Street, basically at the corner of the existing Rite Aid store parking lot. The lease for the land had finally been executed. Regency's vice president of operations, John Farr, said that means that Chick-fil-A can move ahead with the city site planning approvals. And if you drive through Cameron Village, you can see that it's under construction. Among things hovering on the horizon will be nutrition labels on many cuts of meat and meat counters in America's supermarkets. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that this rule will go into effect January 1, 2012. It will require that 40 of the most common cuts of poultry, pork, beef, lamb include labels that disclose to the consumers the total number of calories, the number of calories from fat, and total grams of fat and saturated fat. The labels also must include details about protein, cholesterol, sodium, and vitamins, according to federal officials. The rule will apply to whole cuts of meat and poultry, including boneless chicken breast, tenderloin steak, and ground or chopped meat such as hamburger or turkey, said officials from USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service. The new nutrition labels will either need to be attached to the package itself or be available to shoppers at retail stores and grocers. The USDA officials said that the new rule is required to help Americans be better informed about health benefits and drawbacks of the meat they buy. All this comes as consumer advocates and lawmakers alike rail against the obesity problem among American children, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have reported that American men consume 7% more calories and women 18% more than they did in 1991. These nutrition facts labels were revised in the early 1990s to give consumers uniform information about serving sizes and nutrients, and became mandatory on virtually all processed food by 1994. But meat was, except under a voluntary measure, left out of the labeling overhaul. Now, as the publish rules in the Federal Register, federal officials say they're taking the first step to making such labels mandatory for meat. More and more busy American families want nutrition information they can quickly and easily understand, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said in a statement. We need to do all we can to provide nutrition labels that will help consumers make informed decisions. You might be surprised at what you find. According to the USDA's Nutrition Data Laboratory, a 4-ounce serving of ground beef that is 80% lean contains 280 calories, with 200 of those calories coming from 23 grams of fat. Some local chains are already posting the information, anticipating the new rules. Proponents see this labeling as a weapon against obesity, as customers armed with caloric information can make choices while they're at a restaurant table or stand at a cash register. Americans get one-third of their calories from food prepared outside the home, according to the Food and Drug Administration. With an increased number of cities, counties, and states requiring calorie information on menus, the National Restaurant Association endorsed a national law as a way to set a single standard. North Carolina does not have its own law. The labeling increases costs and hassles for restaurant owners, Association spokesman Michael Donahue said. It's too soon to put a price on the changes, Donahue said, but Congress took cost into account when it decided the requirements should apply only to chains with more than 20 locations. Just as companies decide to change their recipes when the FDA required trans fat labels, calorie labels could spur restaurants to change the way they prepare food to lower calorie counts, said Alice Ammerman, professor in the nutrition department of UNC Chapel Hill's Gilling School of Global Public Health. But it's not clear whether the label changes that change what people eat. Other cities and states have had menu labeling for a few years, and early studies conflict on whether it influences customers' choices. A study by New York University and Yale University of fast food restaurants in low-income New York neighborhoods with high rates of obesity concluded that the information doesn't change what customers ordered. But while a later study by the city's health department said it did, with 56% of customers noticing the labels. Panera Bread started putting calorie counts on its menus in 2010, and the company didn't see any changes in customer preferences when the menu displays were tested in other markets, said John Franzetta, the marketing director for Breadwinners at the Triangle, which has 11 Panera Bread restaurants in the Triangle. Sales don't drop off, Franzetta said. The menu didn't change. Only one of eight customers leaving Panera Bread on six forks saw the labels. The remodeled Golden Corral on Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh, the chain's newest prototype restaurant, prints calorie information in small type at the bottom of cards identifying buffet choices, along with information on serving size, fat, protein, and carbohydrates. On a recent weekday, the nutrition information escaped the notice of eight Golden Corral customers and even one employee. Chris Kuhn, Golden Corral's marketing chief, said since labeling was coming, the company wanted to try it out in its prototype. They will wait until the federal regulations are final before they add nutrition information in restaurants where it isn't mandated, he said. Margot Wooten, the director of nutrition policy at the Center for Science and the Public Interest in Washington, D.C., said more people will notice the labels when the nationwide requirement kicks in. Labeling doesn't stop people from eating out, Wooten says, but lets them know, for example, whether a roast beef sandwich has fewer calories than a tuna sandwich. A majority of Americans are interested in nutrition and want to eat well, eat better, she said. I wonder if her statement is true. It seems that during this recession, we're eating more cereals. Case in point, cereal manufacturer Malt-O Meal announced plans to hire 80 new workers and invest $135 million in its manufacturing plant in Asheboro in Randolph County. Malt-O Meal already employs 200 people in Asheboro. They opened its 350,000-square-foot plant last year. Based in Minnesota, Malt-O Meal makes inexpensive hot and cold cereals and produces 10 of the 50 best-selling brands. This company is enjoying a growing demand for its cereals and gaining market share, even as the overall cereal market is shrinking, spokesman John Austin said. last year's introduction of its Better Oats lineup of instant oatmeal, which is produced in the Ashboro plant, was one of the company's most successful new product launches ever. Austin credits the company's success to products that taste good and offer a better value than the competition. The family-owned company doesn't disclose revenue figures, employs more than 1,700 workers nationwide. Another product made in Ashboro include frosted mini spooners and frosted flakes. An army still marches on its stomach. Napoleon coined the phrase, but it's true today as ever. Good food is essential to good results in war. And out at Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri, Army leaders are taking this aphorism to a higher level. Basic training now includes instruction in health, fitness, and diet. And the food in mess halls there is heavy on fresh fruit and whole grains and lighter on junk food. Military recruits, of course, mirror civilian society, where lousy diet and obesity are a growing problem. Lieutenant General Mark Hertling of the Army Training and Doctrine Command see the need to create the soldier athlete. To do that, we've changed from feeding soldiers to fueling the tactical athlete. The general is a role model in that he competes in triathlons. At posts where the Army has implemented the new diet and exercise programs, leaders are seeing fewer injuries and higher scores on fitness tests. Do you suppose our schools might want to take a look at this, and maybe civilian adults too? Good questions. This might sound a bit strange, but people with suspected food allergies may need to submit to an oral food challenge, ingesting the food in a doctor's office while symptoms are assessed in order to receive an accurate diagnosis, according to a consortium of food allergy experts led by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The guidelines specifically rule out attempting to diagnose a food allergy solely by skin prick or blood test that merely suggests an individual is sensitized to a particular food. These tests, however, may be combined with medical history and exam, and if needed, an oral food challenge to arrive at a diagnosis. According to the recommendations, adherence to the recommendation should help people discover whether they are truly allergic to certain foods, said Dr. Hugo A. Sampson, a professor of pediatrics at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York and past president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. A lot of physicians order large numbers of blood tests of various foods, and when they find small amounts of an antibody present, they indicate to the patient they're allergic to this food and shouldn't eat it, he said. Many patients are placed on highly restrictive diets that are probably not necessary. I'm one of those most fortunate people who is allergic to no food. Of course, I like some items better than others. The humble sweet potato, a staple in Southern cuisine and a perennial favorite on Thanksgiving tables, is looking a lot more cosmopolitan. With the U.S. consumption growing slowly, farmers have found a market for the vitamin-packed, cholesterol-free sweet potato on the tables of health-conscious Europeans. Between 2005 and 2009, the value of the U.S. sweet potato exports more than doubled to $51.4 million, with much of the growth coming from Europe, especially Great Britain. The value of exports to the United Kingdom jumped from $5.7 million to $20.4 million between 2005 and 2009. And in the first 6 months of 2010, exports were on pace to comfortably exceed the last year's total, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Even Ireland, famous for its white potatoes, is getting a taste of the orange kind. Ireland imported $125,000 worth of sweet potatoes in 2009, but that's up from none in 2005. It's a huge change from even 10 years ago when European supermarkets branded the sweet potato as an exotic vegetable and relegated it to a few feet of out-of-the-way shelves in the produce department. And growth has been so swift that it's hard to isolate a single reason for it. It's a great-tasting vegetable, first of all, said Jerome Vick, co-owner of Vick Family Farms in Wilson, North Carolina. Vick has been growing sweet potatoes since 1982, and in the past 5 years has seen Europe become an increasingly important market. along with the 40-pound boxes of potatoes he packs for the American market. He sells potatoes in the European standard 6-kilogram. That's about a 13-pound pack. Vic also follows the food safety standards adopted by the European supermarket chains. They're a little more stringent in terms of food safety, and since we're always been food safety-oriented on this farm, it's a good fit, he said. American farmers are also investing in new equipment to help ensure uniform size and shape of potatoes, said David Picka, a professor at Louisiana State University Agriculture Center. Americans have an advantage over rival farms in countries like Israel, Egypt, and South Africa, Picka said. We can provide a consistently high quality of sweet potato on a year-round basis, and that's something very few countries can do. The biggest boost might have come from farmers' recent promotions, which helped inform European consumers about the sweet potato. 10 years ago, this was an undiscovered vegetable in Europe, he said. We've done a very good job of promoting it and building awareness of the flavor and nutritional value since then. The North Carolina Sweet Potato Commission, for example, has been holding promotions with European supermarkets in the past few years, with the latest one in Sweden. North Carolina, which grows about 47% of the U.S. sweet potatoes, is one of the major producers, along with Louisiana, Mississippi, and California. They're still grown here and still popular here, and now we're seeing them become popular with people all over, said Sue Johnson, the executive director of the North Carolina Sweet Potato Commission. In the U.S., value-added products like sweet potato fries are helping put more sweet potatoes on more plates, but not at a comparable rate like Britain. Per capita American consumption of sweet potato slumped between the mid-1980s and 2003 when it began inching upwards. It's now just over 5 pounds a year, and I feel certain I'm eating a part of someone else's share. All the marketing, new standards, and new equipment help, but farmers like Vic say the vegetable speaks for itself. Sweet potatoes have always been a popular vegetable in the South, but people in the North have always eaten them a lot, too, he said. I guess it just took a little while for the news to make it across the ocean. This Mr. Vic seems to be a very progressive farmer. When customers walk into Common Sense Grocers, it looks like a typical small grocery store until they notice the prices. Sometimes the shelf holds canned salad dressings for 10 cents a bottle, a 16-pound bag of Pedigree puppy dog food for $9.95, and boxes of Rice Krispies for $1.50. Common Sense Grocers, located near the corner of Millbrook Road and Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh, is what is known as in the grocery industry as a banana box store, and offers name-brand groceries to consumers at around 50% off the retail price. When stores pull products off the shelf because they're discontinued or damaged, they put them in banana boxes to sell to wholesalers. Grocery stores such as Common Sense Grocers then buys the products from the wholesalers at a fraction of the price and are able to pass the savings on to their customers. The store is a partnership between Ron Antini, Neil Ferrand, Bruce Berwick, and Charlene Dark, a group of friends who all attend Evergreen Church. When the church lost a long-standing tenant in the building it owned, the group decided to open a business in the spot and settled on a banana box store because there was not a store like it in the Raleigh area. Starting Common Sense Grocers wasn't just about making money for it, Ferrand says. It was about helping the community by producing a low-cost grocery option and helping the church by renting their building. Although the store had a few dented items, it mainly sells items that are in good condition, and all the products on the shelves are name brands and guaranteed to be fresh. And while you're counting pennies, it's an extra punch in the gut to have to buy food in dented cans. It gives our customers a lift to be able to take home nice-looking products, said store manager Lynette Stone. The store has a sizable organic food section, including baby food, and recently introduced an international food section. As a convenience to customers, Common Sense Grocers also stocks milk, eggs, cheese, and sells them at cost. They have begun to accept EBT, which is electric benefit transfers, also referred to as food stamps. Because the store purchases large pallets of items in banana boxes from the wholesaler, They cannot order specific items in their shipments, which come in about once a month. When a new order comes in, it's like Christmas to us because we don't know what products we're going to be getting, Faran says. The store sends out an email newsletter when new products are stocked. The staff at Common Sense puts an emphasis on customer service. Staffers help customers carry groceries out to their car and will match the price of any item priced lower at another store. If a customer is not happy with the quality of them, Stone says, they can simply tell her about it at their next visit and do not even have to bring the product back to get a credit. Stone and other employees also take time out to know their customers. I know whose spouse had just passed away, who had a new baby, and whose son is seriously ill, she said. In addition to being one of the owners of the store, Faran, the father of four boys, is also a customer. My wife and I love shopping at the store, he said. The pricing helps our family, and the variety of products helps the kid to try things we might not typically have bought. I'm going to check this store out, and I'll tell you my impressions. An amateur computer game designer in Raleigh claimed $50,000 cash prize in an Xbox contest to promote Doritos chips and snack foods. Jill Robertson's Doritos Crash Course to game design for the Xbox 360 was selected by her fellow gamers nationwide in a contest on online run by Doritos. As a part of her victory, she will also have an opportunity to consult with Doritos on gaming for 6 months. Robertson, 28, works as a copy center associate at Staples and said the cash will pay for a coursework at Wake Tech in programming or related fields. I knew I had it in me, she said in an interview. I just want to work in retail for the rest of my life. The voting came down to Robinson's obstacle course game versus a race game designed by Justin Carpenter in Utah. The two finalists triumphed over 1,500 ideas submitted in the fall of 2009. Doritos will also awarded Carpenter $50,000. And unlike Robertson, some of the contestants work full-time in video design. Miss Robertson, a native of Iowa, moved to the Triangle with her family at the age of 9. Doritos has enlisted its fans in contests since 2007 when the company gave consumers an opportunity to make commercials to run during a Super Bowl. Congratulations, Jill. One thing we might want to consider for the coming year is to waste less food. It is now estimated about one-third of the food we buy is wasted. And at this time, I want to say thank you for listening. You've been listening to Thought for Food from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And until next time, this has been Bob Kruger.